This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, Tuvalu's new Prime Minister looks certain to rework the country's security treaty with Australia. Fiji's Great Council of Chiefs meet for the first time since they were disbanded more than a decade ago. And amongst the sea of bad news, there's a call for more positive stories out of Melanesia. We'll have more on those stories coming up. We start off in Tuvalu, where the country's new Prime Minister is looking to rework a security treaty with Australia. It's one of the priority points for the new government of Feleti Teo. Marianne Farr delves into the first-time Prime Minister's track record and what's in store for Australia.
After weeks of waiting, the result came swiftly. Tuvalu's new Prime Minister, Feleti Teo, was elected unanimously by all 16 members of parliament.
Feleti Teo comes to the government of Tuvalu after decades, not only of work for Tuvalu, but also for the region.
Sala Dr. George Carter is director for the Pacific Institute at the Australian National University and has been watching the election closely. Voting for the Prime Minister was delayed by more than 3 weeks because of dangerous weather that stopped MPs from travelling to Tuvalu's capital. But yesterday, they finally got together. Mr. Teo was elected unopposed, and Dr. Carter says he's well equipped for the job.
Feleti Teo is a former Attorney General for the government of Tuvalu before going on to regional organizations where he worked within the Foreign Fisheries Agency, the Pacific Island Forum. At one time, he was the acting Secretary General of the Pacific Island Forum.
His return to politics last year came after a stint as the Executive Director of the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission.
He was one of three, or some would say four, strong contenders that could rally and bring together a government, and he has done so successfully.
The result is being watched closely in Australia, which last year signed a landmark agreement with Tuvalu known as the Falapilli Union. The deal gives Australia effective veto power over Tuvalu's security arrangements with other nations. In return, Tuvaluan citizens are given migration pathways to Australia. Feleti Teo was part of the eminent leaders panel that helped craft the deal.
He was one of the key people who was part of these conversations and understands the ins and outs. And so he will also be very instrumental in taking forth that work.
It's a different stance to one of Mr. Teo's key contenders, Anele Sapuanga, who vowed to scrap the agreement if he got into power. But former Tuvalu government advisor Dr. Jessica Marinaccio says the new PM is still likely to seek revisions to the deal.
The security part of that agreement gives widespread power to Australia to the point of being similar to a US compact of free association. And I think most people see that as being a bit dangerous, having language that says that Australia has to mutually agree on any defence or security issue that Tuvalu would undertake.
There's also speculation about the country's ties with Taiwan, after some MPs called for the relationship to be reviewed. Taiwan's foreign ministry has publicly congratulated Feleti Teo on his election, declaring him a friend. Mr. Teo has not yet spoken about his views on the matter.
Given that he has worked for PIF and WCPFC, all of these places where you'd have to deal with both Taiwan and China and countries that recognize both, I am sure that he has a very comprehensive view on this issue.
But Dr. Marinaccio says the more pressing issue may be climate change, which was brought into the spotlight when dangerous weather caused the Prime Minister's election to be delayed by about a month.
But because people were stuck out on their islands and there was a lot of destruction that happened on the capital itself due to the king tides and the weather, we can see that climate change is a really huge issue.
While the issue is concerning, Dr. Marinaccio believes Tuvalu is in good hands.
There is a really good group of politicians that have been elected to represent Tuvalu this time around, especially internationally. We have MPs from all different skill sets numerous lawyers, former diplomats. So it is just very exciting to look at this group and see what kind of things they're going to be able to do for Tuvalu, which I think is great.
Former Tuvalu government advisor, Dr. Jessica Marinaccio, ending that report by Marion Farr. The final details of the security agreement between Solomon Islands and China signed in 2022 are yet to be made public. But one aspect, almost certainly from the deal, is the impact those security arrangements will have on women. Patricia Sango-Pollard is an independent researcher and says concerns lie not only on the Chinese deal, but with a domestic arrangement that have seen the Solomon Islands police force being rearmed.
Women in their own homes, they are already peacemakers, helping with peace resolutions in their household. But coming out, for example, in the ethnic tensions, women has been part of diffusing tensions, going to meet the military people and talking to them and getting them to connect and to bring about peace. And they have been doing that all along. Women's groups, women's network in the Solomon Islands have always been standing up when we have conflicts. They talk about it in the media. They advocate for it to the government. And yeah, they talk to people in their community. So women has always been at the forefront of peace resolutions in the country.
Let's go through some of the research findings looking at China's security treaty with Solomon Islands and even also Australia's bilateral treaty. Can you share the impact on women from those two security agreements?
The impacts are both direct and indirect. So direct would be at the instant, like when we have security agreements and we have assistance arriving when we're in our trouble times, it really helps women because lots of women are in the informal market. So they're sitting out there doing their markets, taking their kids to school and, you know, doing the things around their home. So when we have troubles and we have the security assistant arrived and, you know, it diffuses the tension and everything, women feel safe again. So that's like a direct positive impact of the security agreements that we have with other countries. But as you talk with women, like when you dig further, you can see that the security agreement is like a band-aid for lots of things that should be fixed in our country. So women are still having trouble going to access markets. The health system is broken and women in Solomon Islands are dying from cervical cancer, breast cancer on a very high rate. And, you know, unemployment, mass migration to urban areas, those are the things that when you talk to women, they think that these security agreements is like a band-aid for all the problems that explode every now and then when we didn't fix the underlying causes of the troubles we have in the country.
Before the Solomon Islands government even signed that security pact with China and even the Australia bilateral one, was there any consultation with the community of women?
Maybe they've consulted with the government, but not with the civil society or women's groups. So to see how it will pan out, because we already have a Women's Peace and Security National Action Plan that Australia has helped the Ministry of Women to set up, to develop. So we had that in 2017 when Australia had its bilateral treaty, security treaty with the Solomon Islands. And also we have a national security strategy 2020, but all these security agreements are not connecting to those frameworks. And there hasn't been much consultation that we know of. When I speak to the women who are out there working in the women's ministries and women's networks, there's no consultation in any either of these security agreements.
The government's main reasons for signing that security pact with China was because the Prime Minister was not satisfied with the level of security provided by the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force. And of course, this followed the 2021 riots. Do you think then it does justify the security treaty with China?
For me personally, other people might have their thoughts. I don't think any security agreement with any other country is needed because we don't have any external threats. We just have to fix our own problems that can be fixed with sound policy and implementation. Any security, but for now, with the level we are at now, I think we need it now, but we shouldn't need it in the long run because we need to work on the issues that we have as a country. When you talk to women, they always refer back to the experiences in our ethnic tensions. When we have the guns, the police with the guns terrorizing women in villages, those are state-owned guns. So with the security agreement with China, we don't know if it's, you know, in reaction to that, Australia gave the Solomon police some guns. And so that raises eyebrows with the women like, okay, you just take away the guns after the tensions. Now you bring back the guns again. And is there any strong policies around that? How the use of the guns? Are you going to tell us the public how you're going to use it? So yeah, those are the questions around.
Independent Solomon Islands researcher, Patricia Sango-Pollard. And she was speaking there with the ABC's Agnes Tupou. Some 200 books from the private collection of one of the Pacific's most prominent academics and historians have been donated to Australia's top university. The works were donated to the Australian National University by the family of the late Professor Brij Lal, who died in 2021. Professor Lal spent many years living in exile in Australia after he was kicked out of his native Fiji by the military regime that took control of the country in 2006. The ANU's Information Access Coordinator in the Menzies Library, Jackie Clements, says Professor Lal was a passionate advocate of democracy.
Professor Brij Lal was regarded as one of the finest historians that Fiji has produced, so a world leader in Pacific history and in the studies of the Indian diaspora. So he published over 50 books in his career and contributed to countless others and was involved with editing numerous Pacific publications and series. So the donation includes over 200 books relating to the social, political and cultural experience and context of the group called the Gurmit Chiars, which are indentured labourers from British India transported to Fiji to work in the plantations, along with other countries around the world. And the collection also includes works about the Indian diaspora in the Pacific, particularly Fiji in the 19th and 20th centuries. And the majority of the items we're taking into our collection are from Brij Lal's private library, so primarily from South Asian or Pacific writers, and complement the holdings that we already have. So when the family reached out to us, we were really happy to look at the collection that Brij Lal had in his private collection and taken copies of books and resources that we don't already have in our collection.
200 books, I imagine that would have been quite the stack when it was reeled into the library. Now, you spoke a little bit about his history, saying he was obviously one of the most outstanding Pacific Island historians. Can you zero in a little bit for us on, I guess, what kind of research he did and where he made his big impacts?
So there was a couple of themes in terms of his research, and primarily he worked, did research into things like indentured labour, which is specifically the experience of the Indo-Fijian community and the Gurmit Chiars, alongside Fiji's colonial history and the effects of colonisation on Fijian society, politics and culture, post-colonial politics, which is, and specifically the challenges of nation building, democracy and ethnic relations, with a focus on political instability, coups and ethnic tensions, as well as ethnic relations and identity. So he's had a distinguished career with the ANU since 1990, and he was a fellow of the Australian Academy of Humanities since 1996 and is the founding director of the Centre of Contemporary Pacific. So his list of sort of accolades goes on and on and on along that vein. So he's a very prominent figure in sort of academia in terms of Fijian history and politics.
No, absolutely. Look, I mean, for the mountain of work that he did, it wasn't received well in some areas, I guess most notably in his home country of Fiji, where he was actually exiled from in 2015. Can you talk a little bit more about his work, I guess, in how it related to democracy and I guess why that was so poorly received at the time?
So he was expelled from Fiji in 2009 and then he was prohibited from returning indefinitely in 2015 along with his wife, who was a fellow academic, and her name is Padmanasi Lal. This came as a result of the political tensions in Fiji following the 2006 military coup, and Brij Lal was a vocal critic of the coup and the subsequent military regime. His exile from Fiji significantly impacted his work and personal life. As a historian and academic, he was deeply involved in research and teaching about Fiji's history and politics, and his exile meant he was unable to work or research in his home country. He remained an influential voice in the international community, raising awareness about the political situation in Fiji and the challenges faced by the Indo-Fijian community specifically. His exile highlighted the broader issues of academic freedom and political repression in Fiji during that period. So in 2022, the prohibition order on Padma Lal was revoked, so she was allowed to return with Brij Lal's ashes to Fiji.
And just lastly, Jackie, because we are running out of time, but, you know, you are a librarian. What impact will this contribution have on the ANU library? I mean, can you tell us, I guess, why it's important and why this will be such a, you know, a great legacy for him?
Well, we here in the library I work in the Menzies Library, is the library for Asia and Pacific material and scholarly research. So Brij Lal's works contribute to that sort of scholarship and academic research for students who continue to study at the ANU, particularly in the College of Asia and Pacific. So his research is regarded as having had a lasting impact on scholarship and public discourse and policymaking in Fiji and beyond. So, and his commitment to historical inquiry, social justice and democratic principles, it makes him one of the most respected figures in the academic community and a leading voice for progressive change in the Pacific region. So the wide-ranging impact of his works here in the library means that other scholars and students and members of the public have access to his research and his works and to be enjoyed and read more widely.
That was the ANU's Menzies Library Coordinator, Jackie Clements, and she's speaking there to the ABC's Kyle Evans. While the Pacific is often associated with high rainfall, access to safe drinking water and decent sanitation is bad. In fact, collectively, the Pacific Islands have the lowest rates of access to reliable water supplies in the world. Dr. Regina Sota from Griffith University, Director of the International Water Centre, and she was speaking there to the ABC's Marion Farr.
Many parts of the world have a range of challenges in delivering water services to all of their populations. Some of those that are particularly exacerbated in the Pacific are things like many small communities that are dispersed very wide geographically and a very large rural population. So the capacity for governments or the private sector to provide those services to people who are living in rural areas is really quite challenging.
What lengths are some people in the Pacific going to get safe, clean drinking water? Are you able to give some examples?
As we know is common to many parts of the world, often the responsibility to provide water on a day-to-day basis comes down to the women in households and in communities, and they will often need to walk great distances, many kilometres, certainly hundreds of metres, and then carrying water back to the household to meet their daily domestic needs. Obviously, it's quite difficult to do that and carry large volumes. So what happens is smaller volumes of water get taken back to the house, which means there's less available for some of the activities that might seem a lower priority on a day-to-day basis. So, for example, if there's not a lot of water, then it's quite difficult to maintain safe hygiene practices.
The Pacific is known as being, you know, a very tropical region in most places with high levels of rainfall. Do you find many people are surprised to hear that getting access to safe and clean water is such a challenge?
Yeah, that's very true. A lot of the people that I speak with who don't work with me but ask me about my work are often surprised that the Pacific has any kind of resource challenges, because they have this image of this paradise with a bountiful of all kinds of resources that are needed. But there are certainly many situations in Pacific Island countries where there isn't lots of rainfall or there isn't a lot of locally stored rainfall, for example, some of the coral atolls.
Your research looks into how countries can plan to ensure that they do have access to safe and clean water. How might these plans differ depending on where in the Pacific you live? Why is it so important to kind of take local context into example?
Yeah, look, that's a great question. Communities are largely left to their own capacities to manage water systems. Maybe they've had support to install some infrastructure and perhaps had some training in operating and maintaining that infrastructure, but over time they're largely left to their own devices to govern and manage and troubleshoot and repair those systems. So the local context becomes very important when communities are managing these systems on their own.
Dr. Regina Sota from Griffith University, Director of the International Water Centre, and she was speaking there to the ABC's Marion Farr. At times, the quantity of bad news stories in the media can be overwhelming and can lead to news fatigue. Take Papua New Guinea, for example, Already this year, there's been violent riots in the capital, an outbreak of deadly tribal fighting in the highlands, and a nationwide fuel shortage threatening to bring the economy to a shuddering halt. Well, against this backdrop, the Director General of the Melanesian Spearhead Group, the diplomatic grouping of Melanesian countries, reckons regional media need to do more to give people a sense of hope and pride. Leonard Luma is trying to bring together national broadcasters from the MSG countries to see if they can generate and share more good news stories.
Get our national broadcasters to meet together and see if they can better coordinate their activities in a way that helps build pride in being who we are as Melanesians, and in a subtle way or in a soft way, build the self-esteem of our people. And the aim of it is with, of course, better self-esteem. People would have a different mindset towards how they conduct themselves, and perhaps we would see better developments take place in MSG.
And why do you think that's important to share news from around the region with the region?
Well, for me, if the idea of the establishment of MSG is to develop more enhanced cooperation amongst MSG countries, one of the best ways of getting people to feel like they are part of a community or part of a MSG country is to share news so that all of them know what's happening around, and then develop specific programs in relation to the Melanesian customs and cultures. Too often, I think we do this one-off story, but we don't consistently disseminate information about what's happening in each other's country. For instance, when I see the Pacific Way, ABC does, the Pacific sports program, I see something that could be borrowed from that template and used by our MSG national broadcasters to see if they can specifically do stories on the Melanesian way, the Melanesian sports. You know, there's a whole host of Melanesians in NRL. We hear one-off stories about them, but it's not done in a sustained way which would develop a sense of pride. It gives our youth something to look to.
Going back to your first motivation, which was to build up pride in people, where's the motivation for that come from? Is it because there's often a deluge of bad stories, bad news stories, so to speak, about things happening in Melanesia?
I think, you know, the stories about actual happenings in MSG countries, we should not try and stop that. For me, it is the role of broadcasters and news media to tell it as it is. But as national broadcasters, they were created by governments to promote development happenings in the countries. And for me, I don't think they do enough in that area. I think they should be reminded that, yes, tell whatever is happening as you should and you must, but do not forget that one of your important roles is to develop stories that promote and engender a sense of pride in who we are and encourages our people to develop a positive approach to life. There's there's a lot of feel-good stories.
Leonard Luma, Director General of the Melanesian Spearhead Group, speaking there to the ABC's Liam Fox. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the region. Pacific Review was produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.